House Water Committee meeting for February 11th. We will call it to order as a subcommittee until such time as our membership all arrives. And in doing it as a subcommittee of the committee, we will bypass the House Bill 2033 work session until we get a quorum,
which has happened.
Which we seem to have at present time. With that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2033. Do you have any comments on this for us, Pete?
House Bill 2033, again, is permits the state fish and wildlife director to suspend, deny renewal, or refuse to issue licenses for non-payment of fees owed. Goes back in for an amendment, and you'll see there'll probably be an amendment for this bill that defines for the purposes of the section bycatch, clarifies that the renewal and denial can be for fees owed for bycatch, and modifies the definition of instead of catch. But right now we're with the bill.
Representative Cruz, do you have a motion as to an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the -4 amendment to House Bill 2033.
Representative Cruz moves the -4 amendment to House Bill 2033. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to thank the department for the clarification.
Okay. Any other discussion? Hearing no further discussion, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I would move House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler? Aye.
Representative
Tillman?
Aye.
Dinkfelder?
Excuse.
Representative Krupp? Excuse. Chair Henson? Aye. Having received the majority, House Bill 2033, as amended, will be going to the floor. This is a majority. The House or the Chair would entertain a motion for the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2033 to the floor on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, so ordered. At this point, we will open our informational meeting. We have with us this morning the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and specifically the Fish Department, and we have Ed Bowles, the Director of the Fish Division, or the Fish Division Administrator, with us. And Ed, and or anybody that you feel you need to serve as official muscle there for you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and representatives. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'm pleased to be here today to just discuss with you some of the department's leadership on the conservation and management of Oregon's fishes. And the way I'd like to split this out today, and I've talked this over with the committee administrator, is just a brief introductory and update on our screens and passes program, which is very central to our conservation efforts. And then the two real key pieces that we'll be discussing are the native fish conservation policy, which our commission just recently adopted last winter, and then the hatchery management policy, which is currently under development. And then we'll wrap things up with Robin Brown is going to be here to, he's here now just to speak briefly on marine mammals, the pinnipeds, seals, sea lions, and their relationship to some of the predation on salmon and steelhead. So that's how we'll split it up. Chair?
Thank you. Excuse me. Just for any of you who are here, as you read the initial announcement, you know, on the agenda, talked about dealing with predators. If anybody is here thinking that they want to hear or talk about predators such as cougars and bear, you know, please be advised that that will not be part of our topic here, that we will be confined to principally the predators on salmon as such. And so just for the record, in case anybody has gotten a mistaken idea with that. Excuse me, Ed.
Thank you for that clarification, Chair. First, our just a brief overview of the fish screening and passage. We've very pleased with this program that we have within the department and its ability to really provide service to rural landowners and folks that really are dependent on water for their livelihoods. And the department's fish screening and passage program is charged with working cooperatively with all the water users of Oregon. And this is in collaboratively finding solutions to barriers to fish passage and unscreened water diversions that will protect Oregon's valuable fishery resources. Now, in the past two biennium, the program has made use of OWEB Measure 66 funding, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Service FEMA money, which is Fisheries Restoration and Irrigation Mitigation Act monies, BPA monies, and NOAA Fisheries monies through Mitchell Act, to greatly increase the amount of technical and financial assistance to water users to screen water diversions and provide passage over artificial barriers. I think one of the positive sides to this, in addition to its benefits to the fish, is that this work has prevented enforcement action by federal agencies enforcing the Endangered Species Act, and it has also, I believe, prevented third-party lawsuits, potential for this risk to local landowners. Using the first $4 million provided by OWEB, the department coordinated the construction of 337 fish screens and 21 passage structures. An interesting sidebar to this is that private contractors were involved in 90% of these projects at a cost of $1.3 million. And by that, this money is flowing into those local rural economies. The program's goal is to screen the 3,000 highest priority unscreened diversions in 10 years, over the course of the next 10 years. Now, we have a pretty decentralized screening program. As I alluded to earlier, nearly all of the $12 million in the program funds are spent outside of Oregon's metropolitan areas. This has been particularly important in cities such as the Dalles, John Day, Central Point, Klamath Falls, Madras, and John Day. Now, we have a fish passage task force that's been appointed. It's got members from various fish passage interests, the water users, fishing, conservation, and the public at large. It advised the department on a variety of issues relating to fish passage and greatly aids in our efforts of trying to keep on track with the expectations and providing service to the public. They're also working, you may have heard, we have some of the rules related to small diversions, little blips on the screen, if you will, small culverts and other sorts of things that are really quite cumbersome to go through the process on to getting an exception. We're just working with our commission and the task force to come up with some rules that will streamline this and make these somewhat common sense type problems much easier to resolve. That's all I had on this particular piece. If there are any questions, then I'll move into the native fish conservation policy.
Any questions on? Go ahead, Ed.
Okay. We're very excited to be able to report to you. I know I've been in front of this committee in past sessions and the interim committees on the development of our native fish conservation policy. And so you have before you in one of the handouts the actual rule, administrative rule of the policy. And so any details that you have as far as questions, we can handle. What I'm going to do is just provide an overview of what that policy means to us and how we'll implement it. The purpose of this policy is primarily to delist and avoid future listings. Pretty basic with respect to our native fishes. Because its primary purpose is related to this delisting objective, the focus is on naturally produced native fish, because that is the currency for how we go about currently in measuring success towards delisting efforts, is by those fish coming out of the gravel produced naturally. As I'll get into, that does not necessarily mean that hatchery fish are excluded from this. Hatchery fish can be used as a tool towards producing these naturally produced native fish. A little background on this. You're all aware of the species in decline and the ESA listings that have really changed the whole management backdrop for us as a state. And our challenge is to assert leadership in these listings and moving beyond just recovery planning towards recovery actions. The wild fish management policy has been in place for over a decade, and there were many concerns related to this policy, that it was too inflexible with respect to its standards and the use of hatcheries, too narrow a focus, too weak or strong, and lack of tribal support, and that it wasn't enforced uniformly. It focused primarily as a policy on genetic management of these wild fish, and that focus needed to be expanded to allow it to really be central to recovery efforts. Also, since the wild fish management policy, of course, we've had the governor and legislative leadership on the Oregon plan. And this really required us to step out from just a genetic management sort of policy and really get at a policy that looked at the overall management and recovery of native fish. Now, I'm going to talk just after this presentation on the hatchery management policy, but I wanted to make a distinction first. The hatchery policy that I'll describe to you a little bit later describes the hatchery tool and its range of applications. It also touches on the conservation of native hatchery fish, but it's really just a description of the tool itself. The native fish policy that I'm talking to you about now determines the use of the hatchery tool in specific watersheds. So this is real critical, because this is the primary controversy regarding hatchery and wild fish, is how the hatchery tool is used in the watersheds. That's taken care of through this native fish policy. A few working definitions, just so that we're all on the same page, and these aren't verbatim to the definitions that you'll find in the actual rule, but I've just gotten to the bullets here. Native means indigenous to Oregon. In other words, it has a evolutionary legacy to the state. Hatchery means artificially cultured for part of the fish's life. Wild fish is indigenous and naturally produced. In other words, you can have hatchery fish producing wild fish, okay? As long as they are indigenous to the state and they come out of the gravel, they are wild fish by definition in statute. Sustainable means persistence over time, and conservation is managing for that sustainability or persistence over time, and this is important, at levels supporting both ecological and societal benefits. The goals that we came up with are kind of threefold. First is to prevent serious depletion of native species so that natural production of native fish is sustainable. The second is kind of moving beyond that to maintaining and restoring naturally produced native fish species, so beyond just keeping them from going away. And this is to get at these societal and ecological benefits. And then the third one, very important to the group we were working with, was to foster and sustain opportunities for sport, commercial, and tribal fishers consistent with conservation. So basically, these three goals, if you want to look at them in the context, the first one is really our defensive posture. This is really the goal that says we don't want to go to that dark place where these fish will not rebound from. The second is more of our offensive posture, which is, okay, beyond just keeping them from that dark place, is we want these fish to be healthy and productive for society and for the ecosystems that they're living. And the third is, against the backdrop of all this conservation going on, make sure we don't forget to accentuate opportunities for fishing. That's a big part of what this is all about. Some of the key elements of the policy. Basically, we manage fish in Oregon for three main things. One is so that they are sustainable and naturally produced in their natural habitats throughout the watersheds of the state. The other is we manage fish so that they provide fisheries, both consumptive and non-consumptive. And we manage fish so that they are vital components of the ecosystem. In other words, they provide their carcasses for nutrient enrichment of the watersheds. They serve as predators in these systems, as competitors. So those are the three main things we're managing fish for. Hatcheries are an important tool in meeting these objectives. And we make that clear in our policy when used responsibly. We'll be managing for the sustainability of population clusters or aggregates based on fish performance. And this is an important distinction from the old wild fish management policy, which was primarily every stream, every species in every stream was treated as a somewhat separate unit towards the conservation of the fish. This allows us, similar to what the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries has, is basically a grouping of populations that have to clear the bar for recovery. Our policy points towards addressing the primary factors of decline and proceed with caution scaled to risks. Another key objective, once again, is providing fisheries consistent with this conservation. Not excluding fisheries just for the sake of conservation. Implementation of the policy. The plans will be based on what we're calling conservation plans. They'll have specific standards and range of management options. And I need to mention, Chair, that there was a lot of concern that the real prescriptive, detailed standards are not really located in this native fish policy, and many people were looking for those. The key here is that we've moved away from a one-size-fits-all statewide policy and recognize that these plans have to be developed kind of custom-tailored to the local watershed conditions. And because of that, you really can't prescribe a specific standard that would represent all species in every stream statewide. Therefore, those standards will come about through these conservation plans. They will provide these opportunities for flexibility within and among watersheds, and it dictates that we work very closely with our management partners so that we have a unified conservation effort. This is critical for the Oregon plan implementation, as well as all of the coordinated co-management that we do throughout the Columbia Basin. Obviously, at this time of budget constraints, the pace of our implementation of this policy is going to be scaled to the resources, but we are confident that we can still move ahead in critical areas, even starting today. Interim standards, while we develop these conservation plans throughout the state, will be based on existing rules until those are reviewed and incorporated, just so there's no policy vacuum.
Ed?
Yeah.
Just as a clarification for the committee, on your existing resources, and appreciate that resources are scarce in the state, you know, right now. But are your existing resources for the management here from general funds or from other funds? Or are they a and federal funds, are they a combination of, or exactly how do your resources fall out there?
Chair Jensen, we have a mix of funds, some of them discretionary and some non-discretionary. And when you roll in, we view the hatcheries as a tool for fish management within here. And so even within the hatchery system, we have a mix of general fund, which is, you know, slipping away, obviously, what we call other funds, which is through primarily licensed dollars and some contract dollars with, for example, private utility companies. And then we have a largest portion of it in federal funds. Now, for the basic district biologists and other biological management outside of the hatcheries, we also have that same mix. It also includes, though, what we call federal aid program for a lot of our district biologists. That is a matching program with federal monies through the Wallet Borough Act. We have Bonneville Power Administration dollars that help out, well as some limited general fund and primarily other fund license dollars. So it's quite a mix of funding sources.
Thank you.
Really central to the whole thing we're trying to bring to the recovery planning process is a simple fish management foundation. We're basically several steps we're going to be looking at, and it's really just kind of common sense management. It's the same thing you do throughout your lives when you're dealing with trying to achieve your goals. The first thing is to describe the management unit boundaries. Essentially, draw a circle on the map around those populations that you're calling similar, that you're going to be managing. Then determine the desired status, or what is the bar for recovery for that group of populations. And then, using those attributes that you define the bar with, you need to also, using those same attributes, determine where you are right now. What is your existing status? And then, if there is a gap between where you are and where you want to be, determine the primary causes for that. And this is where our biological expertise is most important. And then, what available management actions do we have in order to bridge that gap? And what is the likelihood of our success with those management actions? And which...
Before you get away, desired status, is that something you're determining? Or, I mean, because clearly the to be delisted, it's a desired status that has to be set at the federal level. So how is that process working? How are you working with what used to be NIMS? What are they called now anyway? They're part of NOAA now, but... Okay, they should, actually the whole program should be in U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but that's another issue. I mean, how is that working to arrive at those?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, this issue of what exactly does the bar look like and how would we describe it has been quite a subject of debate of late. And in fact, there was House Bill 3002 last year formed the Recovery Task Force, Legislative Task Force, that Chair Jensen was a key contributor to. And they actually struggled with the same issue, had a workshop on it. What exactly does it mean? We are confident that we are starting to bring everybody together on this. And we know that the bar is not a one-size-fits-all, but it represents several key attributes. Related to the abundance of the fish, their distribution, their productivity or survival, and the diversity of their characteristics. And so given that, we need to, for each species and each grouping of populations, put some numbers to those attributes. That is currently being put in play, Representative. The federal, it's called NOAA Fisheries now, they have what are called technical recovery teams that we have inserted ourselves into as not representational, but as experts, you know, on the fish here in Oregon. And we are helping them define those. Those have the opportunity for public involvement in that before those are finalized. Within our state policy, we will be having full public involvement as we move forward in describing the desired state. Now, the key here is that what we call the desired status is not necessarily pre-European development. It is sustainability, okay? There's a big difference there. But we define sustainability not just as museum piece management, where the fish are just there but don't touch them or they'll break. It's sustainability is basically populations healthy enough to not only contribute to their ecosystems, but to contribute to society through fisheries.
Okay. Do you have a rough timeline on NOAA fisheries process when we're going to see at least some preliminary findings?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, depends on the location because you can't do this everywhere at once.
Right.
And depends on the species. But right now there are some areas where they already have some drafts out on some of these numbers. They're currently developing some for the many of the Willamette and evolutionary significant units, and they have some of those numbers out. We are commenting on those now as far as where they fit.
Okay, are they focusing on coho first or?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, once again, it varies depending on the location. We do have some areas of for coho. As an example, we have a state ESA, as you're well aware, and we have a listed species in the Lower Columbia River, the coho. And in just a short period of time, as quite remarkable, our staff put together, using this approach, a recovery plan for Lower Columbia River coho and actually defined the bar and where we're at and the steps needed to get there. And it was just a six-month process, basically. And in there, we actually have this set out. And if you'd like, I can provide you copies of that so that you can understand what the bar looks like.
Okay. I'd be interested in that, Mr. Chair, and also maybe just an example of what NOAA has done relative to the state of Oregon at this point in time.
Chair Jensen, I'd be happy to provide that. I didn't bring those slides today, but I can provide those to you.
Thank you.
Once you determine the management actions to close the gap between where you are and where you want to be, a key piece of this is monitoring and evaluation. None of this is done with certainty, and therefore you need feedback mechanisms to tell you whether or not you've ventured down the wrong path and need to alter courses, and more importantly perhaps, when you've arrived at where you want to be, so that you know when you've done enough. Expected outcomes of this approach, very important that we get more broad ownership in these conservation plans. Local constituents and the publics are going to be very important in the success of these recovery actions, and therefore they need to be involved at the ground level, we believe. And these conservation plans also need to be focused on the primary limiting factors. We will be using, rather than reinventing a process, we'll be using the NIMS recovery process, the Power Planning Council, sub-basin plans, and the Oregon plan venues already in place in order to implement this policy. We're not going to go out and do this all independent of things going on now. We want to shift from recovery planning to recovery actions with the monitoring and evaluation necessary to adapt our management. We hope that this approach is going to be less divisive in the debate over hatching wild fish. We want to do this by clarifying the role of hatchery fish and its range of uses that I'll talk to you in just a minute on. The key here is to move away from what I call good fish, bad fish, towards getting the right tool for the right job in addressing these limiting factors so that hatcheries can be used responsibly to actually aid in the conservation of fish. We want to also have a clear description of the primary management approaches to meet these objectives. In other words, areas with a hatchery focus will be mapped out, and areas managed for minimal hatchery influence will be designated. And I have some examples of how this, now this is hypothetical, but just show you across the landscape how this policy may play out. The blue represents This represents the coastal coho ESU, and the blue part of this would be experimental conservation hatchery programs. You'll see some range among the watersheds where some watersheds are focused on this approach. We also have more hatchery experiments going on with reintroductions, shown there in kind of the fuchsia color. The other hatchery component would be the red, which is where we're focused is on harvest type programs with very little standards for concerns with natural production. Then we also have areas where we have minimal hatchery influence that'll be used as control areas as we move forward in these experiments on hatcheries, mm-hmm. and also as important anchor areas for the fish, so that because this hatchery tool is experimental with respect to these conservation approaches. Now this is just for the hatchery component. Remember, we have other tools in the toolbox that include harvest management. Other agencies, regulatory agencies, have habitat management issues, disease control, predator control. All those things are tools. This is just one of those tools and how across the landscape you may see this. Yes, Chair.
As I look at this, I'm curious at what went into or what will go into the policy to determine which of those watersheds will be minimal hatchery influence and which will be experimental, etc., sort of thing. The concern I have in relationship to this is one could very nicely bias this so that the hatchery program would be somewhat destined for failure. And so I'm curious whether this is a random sort of selection or what it is that will be used to make these determinations.
Sure, Chair Jensen. Of course, the other aspect of this is the not in my backyard component of this. We would like this to be primarily biologically driven based on the needs of the fish. Obviously, areas where we're moving forward with conservation hatchery experiments would be done in areas that we think are strong, viable candidates for natural production. And therefore, we would not want to have areas that the habitat can't support natural production and then throw a hatchery in there and then have it fail. Just to show that hatcheries fail. I mean, that certainly would not be appropriate. We want this a good mix across the watersheds. If you look at this shows the full ESU. If you look at this just represents one particular watershed in the ESU, once again, hypothetical. But here it shows kind of a suite of options within the watershed as well, where you have the green once again, which may be what you can call an anchor area for natural production to monitor where the population's going, and then different conservation hatchery approaches, and then with the red block being a primary area that you're not concerned about hatchery influence on stray rates and other things like that. Now, a key piece to this is that, as the hatchery tool proves itself in a conservation light, you may implement it in broader areas. If it does not prove itself a useful tool, it may diminish in these areas. But we want to study this at a grand scale within the watersheds and use the monitoring and evaluation in order to tell us whether or not this is moving in the right direction. The primary way, Chair Jensen, of determining how this lays out across the landscape will be with these local groups in these watersheds with a technical sideboards provided to them on basically what the fish need in order to prosper, and then having them help us shape where we're going to focus. Obviously, we're not going to pick up and move our primary hatcheries around, Chair Jensen. Therefore, you have somewhat of a default where those are going to reside. Mm-hmm. But you do have the opportunity for these. If you look this area right here in the yellow and in the purple area, those are satellite facilities, and those we do have some options on where we can move them around. A good examples of how this is playing out would be in Northeast Oregon with the Nez Perce and Umatilla tribes, where we have this kind of in play right now and are working things out with those management partners on where is the appropriate place for control streams, where are the appropriate places for treatment streams. I'll show you one more.
Before you move too far away from that, two maps ago, what was the southernmost stream in that ESU? I'm looking at the coast, trying to determine exactly where that is. Do you know where that is?
Right. This takes you down, you know, through the Umpqua. The Rogue is not in the system.
The Rogue is kind of the divider. Okay. And now go to your next map and. An acclimation facility, is that where you take smolts hatched someplace else? And I mean, what's the difference between an acclimation facility and a hatchery? I'm not familiar.
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, these are basically places where you have a centralized hatchery system. Obviously, it's prohibitive to build hatcheries everywhere, but you may have a particular drainage that you want to use the hatchery tool in, and you want to get those smolts acclimated, if you will, to that area before you release them. It aids in the imprinting of the fish on that water source, and it also aids in letting them adjust to the stresses of being transferred before the release.
Okay, would things like hatch boxes be included in that or not?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, we wouldn't need an acclimation facility for that.
That
is correct. That is correct.
The STEP program fits into that concept of what you're...
Yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Thank you.
This is a real life example. Representative Cruz brought up about the Lower Columbia River coho that I talked to briefly before, and this shows actually what the recovery plan has for the hatchery tool in the Lower Columbia River. We have hatcheries where those stars are, and what we've done now within this recovery plan, and this shows kind of this policy in play, if you will. We've got the dark green and the lighter green as the areas that are somewhat off limits to hatchery interactions and hatchery production, complemented with areas that we have primary management emphasis on hatchery fish and kind of the pink of fuchsia areas. Then those middle tribs in the blue area, those are managed for naturally produced fish, but we'll be using within the recovery plan hatchery fish as a tool to supplement those, but they'll be managed primarily for recovering those tributaries. And we are currently just waiting to see how much pioneering we get from the naturally produced fish in there, how much of the hatchery tool is needed. But those may have different approaches, such as planting embryos in the gravel. They may have hatch boxes, they may have smolt productions in some of those tributaries. Now, if you have a one-size-fits-all policy regarding stray rates, regarding use of the hatchery tool, this sort of mosaic is not possible. And this is what we're trying to move towards, is custom tailoring each of our tools, not just hatcheries, but harvest management and all the other management tools we have, custom tailoring it to get the right tool for the right job in the particular watersheds that these species reside. This shows how this would play out for the hatchery tool for Lower Columbia River coho.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Representative Schumer. Thank you. The two in the middle there, where are they at, please?
Chair Jensen and Representative Schumer, this is basically the...
Okay, take your light down to the two stars there. The two hatcheries right there. Yeah,
okay, this is the Sandy and the Clackamas.
All right.
All right. This is the Hood River system here. We've got Bonneville here. This is, Scappoose, Classic 9, and then your Lower River where we have a bunch of hatcheries on Big Creek and down in the lower part of the Columbia. Okay.
Thank you.
Need to move on. I just want to touch briefly on the task force. very pleased with kind of the timeout that we had in our native fish conservation policy development to have a much more embracive public input process. Diverse range of interests in the task force we put together. We spent 3 months, 9 meetings, and over 80 hours in this facilitated process. And as you can imagine, it was quite controversial because we're dealing with these hatching wildfish issues. The facilitator summed up the task force as a dedicated effort by people who care deeply about the future of native fish in Oregon and their impact on society. We're able to reach broad consensus on the draft rules and the final rules with relatively few areas of impasse, which was quite remarkable. And a lot of that I'd like to attribute to the actual participants in the task force and their desire to actually come out with a product that could move us forward on fish management. Next steps, hatchery policy that I'll talk to just in a minute, be completed and adopted this spring. We'll be reviewing existing rules for integration into the native fish policy by August of 2003. That's the rest of Division 7 administrative rules. And of course, beginning these conservation plans, we want to be very aggressive in the beginning on these. Any questions, additional questions on the native fish policy?
Yes, Ed. I have a question going to the March of 2002 IMST report on hatchery policy versus and the conservation native fish conservation policy. They make some recommendations and observations. Would you be prepared to comment on that, or is that an unfair question? Since you probably
Chair Jensen, I'd be happy to comment on it if you could just remind me. Can you give me a specific comment that they had?
They start out first that, however, the native fish conservation policy should take precedence over the hatchery policy. And then says, while the proposed hatchery policy is quite comprehensive, we offer the following comments on important elements we believe should be included. The hatchery policy needs to coincide with the native fish conservation policy. There should be more explicit discussion of how the hatchery policy would be integrated into a landscape perspective, what this really means and how it would function. And the following questions should be addressed. What policies or guidelines will guide decisions concerning the number of hatchery fish liberated into a watershed given various abundant scenarios of wild fish? The criteria concerning the liberation of hatchery fish should be formulated for each watershed before supplementation takes place. What policies and guidelines should be followed concerning the number of hatchery fish liberated under different environmental conditions? And what policies and guidelines will direct hatchery operations as part of the adaptive management decision at the landscape level?
Chair Jensen, many of those issues will be touched on in the hatchery management policy, the specifics of how we go about with releases and those numbers. But I, as we've discussed with the IMST, we want to make it clear that because this is a statewide policy, and we have a key component of this new policy is the ability to custom tailor these standards and criteria to the local watersheds that these fish reside in. It is important, you know, that these main standards will not come into play until you do these local conservation plans. And that's where you will then sit down with the local public as well as the biologist and say, okay, here's how the hatchery tool plays out in this particular watershed. Here's where you may use hatch boxes appropriately. Here's where you'll have a smolt program. Here's where you will have very little influence from hatchery fish within the watersheds and concentrate on a different tool available to you. That will be done custom tailored through these local conservation plans, and that's consistent with the way the federal government is now approaching this. We've had this discussion with the IMST, and they understand that really the clear picture of the landscape, where a particular, where you're focusing on hatcheries, where you're not, how much hatchery fish are being released, they're really not going to see that until we're able to get these conservation plans put together. To dictate that in an overall statewide policy would basically preclude the local public from being involved in that process.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative Sharma.
Thank you. Well, you can answer these probably throughout your hatchery discussion, but are we no longer taking eggs from one creek and putting them in another? And are we feeding these hatchery fish so that we maximize their potential survival going downstream? I guess the way you feed them has a difference. And in the release of these fish, are we releasing them, staggering it so that we're not conditioning pinnipeds to sit there when dinner time? If you're gonna address all those, fine, whenever you go about that. But those are some things I'm curious about.
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, I will get into that a little bit within the hatchery policy, so if I don't answer it specifically, why don't you remind me again?
Thank you.
Once again, the hatchery management policy, this gets at what Chair Jensen was just bringing up, kind of the overarching policy and strategic plan for hatchery management across the landscape. The hatchery policy describes the hatchery tool and its range of applications. It does not determine the use of hatchery tool in specific watershed. That'll be determined in these conservation plans through the native fish policy. So because of that, I'm hopeful that some of the controversy related to the hatchery fish, we can avoid that within this particular policy. Now, there is some controversy that we'll get into that I'll share with you some of our guidance on. But the goal of the hatchery policy is simply to provide a tool to benefit fisheries and help conserve native fish, consistent with the legal mandates and fish management objectives. The key here is that this is a tool, a management tool. General framework that we'll be looking at for hatchery programs, they have to be able to provide either fishery or conservation benefits. In other words, they have to be meeting some objective. We want to be much more inclusive of the public and our management partners through our hatchery programs. Develop and utilize operational plans so that there's clear transparency in what we're doing and why we're doing it. And once again, all of this is done in somewhat uncertainty, therefore you've got to have monitoring and evaluation as a feedback loop. Now, those are the hatchery programs. We also manage, you know, we have these hatchery facilities, and the key here is that we're managing them for to produce a good product and that these hatcheries themselves are good residents of their watershed. This is more and more important with some of the Clean Water Act requirements that we're facing today. If two basic program types within our hatcheries, and we want to keep these distinct: harvest hatchery programs and conservation hatchery programs. The harvest objectives are to enhance fisheries without eroding the sustainability of naturally produced fish. You'll notice a distinction here, but the conservation objective is to increase the number of these naturally produced fish without reducing the productivity of these fish. This is a bit different. One of them is to provide fishing opportunities while being good neighbors to the wild fish. The other one is to actually be a tool to increase the numbers of the wild fish themselves. Quite different objectives, and we want to keep these programs distinct so that these harvest objectives don't blur this line.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cruz.
I'm a little confused here. Why the two objectives? Is it basically because some of the hatcheries are not structured to produce the right type of fish. I mean, if we're doing wild crosses in the hatcheries, and so we are putting in the streams fish that are genetically identical. I don't understand what the problem with that is. You talk about without reducing productivity of wild fish populations, to all intents and purposes, if you're doing appropriate hatchery management, you are producing wild fish. So I guess I'm a little confused at the difference here.
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, the key difference here is that we've been operating hatcheries for over 100 years mm-hmm. with a primary objective of producing fish for harvest, and we're pretty good at it. In recent times, it's just been in the past decade or so that we've really tried to use this tool to actually increase the number of naturally produced fish so that we can aid delisting. And the use of that tool is not well known yet, the appropriate use of it and the consequences. But what we do know is that using the current harvest-oriented programs and just saying, okay, now we're going to put these fish out and call it a conservation program, does have risks associated with it. We haven't always done some of the things that you've talked about, set those fish up for success as best we can because they were geared towards maximizing harvest opportunities. Now, as we shift some of these programs towards more localized brood stocks, more natural rearing techniques, and perhaps less abundance of smolt numbers, the numbers of fish we're putting out in some areas, we can probably reduce these risks and blur the lines a little bit more. But currently, with the current way things are set up, we need to keep them distinct, not only from our standpoint of learning as we go, but also because of our objectives that we have. Now, give me an example. Some areas that we have, the majority of our hatcheries, quite frankly, are what we call mitigation hatcheries. They're there in a settlement agreement with some utility or the federal government to provide fishing opportunities, period. That's what they're there for. Replace lost fish due to hydropower development. For those, our discretion in turning them into what we would call true conservation hatcheries isn't real large as far as our opportunities there. They're there to provide fishing. In those cases, we want to maintain that objective, but do so in a way that those hatchery fish that are providing fisheries are good neighbors to the wild fish around them. In other words, they're not causing negative impacts.
Okay, part of my confusion here is, for a long time, what was said about hatcheries is that they were inferior fish, but we've proven, and the tribes have done a good job of establishing this, that you can produce fish in hatcheries of virtually any kind that are genetically identical to the wild fish. And I know there is concern over behavioral differences of the smolts, but I don't think anybody is trying to maintain that behavioral difference of the first few months of life is genetically transferred in one generation. So my question is, if they're genetically identical fish and they survive the life cycle and come back to spawn, I don't understand. I mean, because clearly the strongest survive, whether they come out of a hatchery or out of gravel. So if they come back to spawn, how would allowing the fish that were in the hatchery to spawn be having a negative impact on the fish that already existed there?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, the current hatchery programs that we have in place, which are geared towards harvest-oriented programs without a lot of wild fish infused in those brood stocks, in many cases are quite different from the naturally produced fish in the watersheds.
But if we were doing wild crosses in those hatcheries, they wouldn't be, would they?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, that would be one step towards narrowing the gap. There are many others as well. If you look at, and I'll get to a little bit later in here, some of our, we want to be very aggressive at narrowing the perceived gap between hatching wild fish as we move forward with this tool. Right now, let me give you just some examples. It's not only just making sure you have, let's say, locally adapted brood stocks, it's also how you collect the brood stock so that it represents the spectrum of the run timing, the feeding protocols that you have. Some examples relating to behavior issues that you brought up, Representative, are, you know, hand feeding above the raceways can train a fish that when they see a shadow to come to it to get fed. Well, in the wild, that shadow could be a kingfisher, which results in loss of the fish. Just subtle things like that are very important. The densities of fish that we raise in a hatchery vastly exceed what the fish are used to in the wild, and can have consequences on their ability to survive as well. So there are lots of things that we do in the hatcheries that weren't bad. They were simply to meet an objective of producing fish that will come back for harvest. May not have been the best approaches for keeping that fish from slipping from its wild roots. And we need to be aggressive and careful as we narrow that gap back so that these fish can play an important role in recovery. But that's an experimental role we want to do at a large scale, similar to what we've embraced with some of the tribal efforts and we're doing in some of our watersheds. But we do not have that tool defined well enough now to simply just say, go forth and treat all of these fish as the same.
Okay, can I, just one more follow-up. Are you, or is anybody maintaining, for example, and I understand there are some behavioral things that may be present, and so the hatchery smolts, as they're going out to the ocean, the mortality may be a lot higher than the other fish. But clearly most smolts die at some point in the life cycle anyway. So are you maintaining, or is anybody maintaining, that those hatchery fish that may have this behavioral thing as a smolt and are lucky enough to survive come back to spawn, that the progeny of that spawning is going to have that surface behavioral trait inbred in it?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, some of these are what we call heritable traits and others aren't. For example, something that's learned, like what I talked about, coming to a shadow to be fed, that's obviously not going to be heritable from that standpoint. Sure. Other aspects will. Let me give you some examples of, like I just mentioned, hatchery fish are raised typically at very high densities relative to what's in the natural streams, much, much higher densities. Because of that, some of the fish that are best equipped in the wild are fish that are very territorial and don't like to be real gregarious. Steelhead are a particular example of this. And yet in a hatchery, we select basically for those fish, and we actually force them somewhat to get along together in very close confinement. Those fish, there's some theory and hypothesis that's being tested now that some of those fish that drop out as what are called pinheads in a hatchery are actually those fish that can't get along with such close quarters, and yet those may be the very fish that may perform well in the wild. That's one example. Another example is we tend to raise some of these fish uniformly without really providing them with any of the, for example, predator avoidance issues, things like that, that may be heritable. So they're not exposed to that. So we allow all those fish to survive in a hatchery. We're going to be looking at ways of tweaking some of our facilities, and I want to get to a point where I'm going to talk about a concept for a research facility where we actually are able to recreate some of these natural stream conditions and then see if we can narrow that behavior and genetic that heritable side of things to the point where we're blurring these lines between the hatchery and wild fish. And we're pretty excited about where we're heading on this and getting some pretty broad support to move forward on that. Now this, I want to clarify, Representative, that this does not mean that we're holding back and just going to study these fish in a textbook setting. what we are talking about in this native fish policy and our hatchery policy is watershed scale use of the hatchery tool, but coupled with very aggressive monitoring and evaluation so that we can learn, because we do admit that we don't know all the answers on the use of the hatchery tool as a conservation tool. And so we're talking about in Northeast Oregon with many of the tribal efforts, watershed scale supplementation projects using a variety of techniques. Some may use smolts reared in conventional raceways. Some may use acclimation ponds and pre-smolt releases. Other places we may use early release of hatchbox fish or unfed fry. Coupling all these together throughout, not just Oregon, but in Washington and Idaho as well, we believe we can move aggressively forward in helping refine this tool. Remember, this is a new use of the hatchery tool. To the credit of the hatchery managers, to expect them to be able to just suddenly turn a light switch and have this tool refined would be a tough expectation for us. It's taken 100 years for us to refine the tool for harvest purposes, and we're still learning as we go. And we're going to have to treat it as a tool for conservation purposes. But I would be disappointed if we simply sat in a textbook setting and studied this for another 20 years. We have to learn on the ground with carefully controlled experiments.
I could go on with this debate for a long time, Mr. Chair. I think I'll let him do his presentation.
I just want to clarify this conversation from my own thinking. So what you're saying, you want to go, not necessarily from, but not just use the hatchery for breeding fish that will go out and return for sport fishing and consumption and harvest, but also use the hatchery as a way of breeding fish that will go out, come back, and breed naturally again, rather than just using it for a harvest cycle kind of thing.
Chair Jensen and Representative Schauffler, that is correct. That is the new role that the region is exploring right now, mm-hmm. as an aid for recovery or as a safety net for naturally produced fish while we fix the primary limiting factors.
Okay, thank you.
For these harvest hatchery programs, as Representative Cruz was talking to, even for the harvest programs, we would like to try to integrate the hatchery and natural systems together to try to blur these lines through. And some of this is, we've already been talking about using local brood stocks and simulate natural rearing characteristics. And this is even for the harvest hatchery programs, but it won't be as accentuated as much as for the conservation hatchery programs. We will be, though, separating hatchery and naturally produced fish in the fisheries and on the spawning grounds as necessary, and the monitoring evaluation. Now, the conservation hatchery programs, this integration of the artificial and natural production systems is even more critical, as we've been talking about, because these fish have the objective of blending in with their wild neighbors. Want to proceed with caution in limited areas, monitor and evaluate while we address some of the root causes of decline. Now, the vehicle for how the public and others are going to be able to track what we're doing here is through hatchery and genetic management plans. This is a vehicle that the federal government has imposed on us through the permitting process, and we're going to just adopt this, adjust it a little bit so that we can use it to our advantage of having a way to catalog and track what we're doing. And so we'll use it for implementation. It'll include all of our objectives and specifics. This gets at the IMST questions that Chair Jensen brought up of showing how it fits within the landscape. Be based on basin plans or existing fish management direction and be consistent with the native fish policy. So these hatchery and genetic management plans, which are already being developed, will be your way of tracking what we're doing for a particular hatchery and your way of knowing how that hatchery fits within the broader landscape. This is what I thought we'd probably spend a lot of our time today on. I'm not sure how much time I have left, but we have specific in the policy, Chair Jensen, basic fish culture from A to Z, direction on how we're going to rear these fish. And Representative Schaffler, you brought up, you know, what are we going to do for rearing these fish and releasing them in order to make them more naturally oriented? And we have several things along the lines of fish culture, all the way from broodstock, source and collection, what we do with adult surpluses, spawning and incubation, rearing, marking, handling, releases, fish health. All of these are critical. They're all lined out in the policy. Some of it will be more prescriptive than others because we don't want to, we want to allow custom tailoring of these hatchery programs where appropriate. I'm just going to touch on a couple of these to give you some examples. Broodstock collection. We will be, as Representative Cruz was appealing to us, was a focus on transitioning to these local broodstocks, which is going to be a step in the right direction. But this will not be appropriate everywhere, throughout, in every basin. So this is not going to be a statewide prescriptive policy. We want to be collecting from the spectrum of the run, as we talked about. Harvest hatchery priority uses. This is when the broodstock is collected. The first priority is going to be for the hatchery broodstock, then tribal ceremonial subsistence, recycled fisheries, natural spawning, stream enrichment, egg and carcass sales, and food share. This is in priority order within our draft policy of what these fish would be used for as they come back to the hatchery.
Tell me, what's food share?
Food share is basically the food bank that goes throughout Oregon to feed needy homes and families. It's been very successful the past 2 years.
I just wondered why. I thought that's what it was, and I wondered why it came as the last priority. But that's a question I'll leave for Representative Cruz and his committee.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to have to deal with Donna on that one.
Yes, sir.
This is now for the conservation hatchery priority uses. This is once again the reason why we need to keep these programs distinct. If you look here for the conservation hatchery priority uses, the number one use for fish coming back is to spawn naturally. That's their objective, whereas on the harvest hatcheries, it's for hatchery broodstock after the fishery. Then we get into stream enrichment, tribal ceremonial subsistence, fisheries, and food share.
Mr. Chair, getting back to your harvest hatcheries, kind of a little off the subject, but something that I think will be ramping up because we've discovered we have a very viable market in China for operating fish farms on our coast. Are we in a position with our harvest hatcheries to supply those operations, or are we talking something outside of the universe we already have? Or have you even really gone into that yet?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, are you referring to net pens offshore?
Yeah.
Currently, Oregon does not have any of these net pen private aquaculture.
Right. I understand that, but our conversations with China, who is now getting their salmon from, I think, Nova Scotia, I think, or Iceland or someplace, Norway. You know, we kind of developed that science, and then it got exported to Chile, basically, who is just doing gangbuster business, and the science has been perfected now to where they're creating some very viable, marketable fish, and I think that we're going to see a move in that direction as clearly one way to kind of boost coastal economies if we can do that, and I'm wondering if our harvest hatchery system is in a position to augment that industry.
Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, you know, currently we are not supportive of coastal net pen operations in Oregon because of the ecological impacts from losses from those containers. Washington is looking into this and doing it in areas as well as British Columbia. Alaska is adamantly opposed to it. That is a policy issue that will have to be dealt with within our commission as well as perhaps the state look at policy considerations of that, but currently that is not something we would support.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Is that what they call a hypoid in Washington? A fish called a hypoid that raises in pens? I was fishing up right by the Chief Jopas Dam one day with a guide, and he drove by one of those pens, and he said we might catch some fish out of there. Is that what he was talking about right there?
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, there are different types of genetic manipulation of some of these fish to make them sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And hyploid and triploid are different genetic techniques in order to sterilize them. And they may have become, you know, it's truly a haploid and triploid. But it may be that the locals may start calling them that as a common usage. But those, you know, the species are still primarily Atlantic salmon that are used in these net pens. There is some experimentation with Pacific salmon, but they're primarily Atlantic salmon. And that would probably be what they were referring to.
And the concern is that they will somehow not be sterile and start breeding in our waters and screw up all our native fish? Is that your concern?
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, yes. That's one of the concerns. There's also concerns on the effects of water quality in these high mass-produced areas in these coastal estuaries and bays, and its effects on the coastal ecosystems. There's also concerns of pathogens and diseases resulting from these. A whole myriad of things that need to be looked at thoughtfully and carefully before we move forward on something like that. Outside of our purview, which is on the biological side of this, there is societal concerns about the loss of support for commercial and fishing on the wild stocks and putting those commercial fleets out of business.
Thank you.
Okay. Probably need to move on to get to the
just showing
issue.
Thanks, Chair. We have rearing issues that we'll be looking at as Representative Cruz and I discuss techniques to mimic nature without losing the health and production objectives that we have. Diet, best performance at lowest cost, and also certain areas where we'll be looking at, as an example, midwater feeding so that the food doesn't come out on the surface, and it's more the types of food that will be used by these fish in their natural settings. Predation, minimize attracted predators to these raceways from above, but in some cases, this sounds pretty ludicrous to some, but in some cases we may try to mimic natural predators in some of these systems to allow some of the training to these fish. Marking is real critical to us. We will mark hatchery fish prior to release if it's necessary to evaluate or if they may be caught in or returned to areas with naturally produced fish. It is our marking program that has allowed the citizens of Oregon to take advantage of these good runs we've had in recent years because these hatchery fish are mixed in with these naturally produced fish that are listed and has allowed us to keep our impacts low while we reap the bonanza of these good returns of hatchery fish. I can't stress enough the importance of monitoring and evaluation. In the past, the focus for our hatchery programs was monitoring and evaluating in-hatchery survival and the contribution of the hatcheries to fisheries. As we've been talking, the future will focus on post-release survival and the impacts to natural populations and watershed health. Okay. Next step, and this is the end, so we're done here. The hatchery policy we're pursuing with workshops, two public and one internal. We've had one public workshop already. We have an internal one coming up Wednesday, and then another public workshop coming up the end of the month. So February is key for this policy development. We'll have tribal, state, and federal input via USB Oregon negotiations. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission have public hearings on this March 21st and May 9th. To take comments, and then action will take place on May 9th.
That action would be then the adoption of the hatchery policy. Is that what you're...
Chair Jensen, it's up to the discretion of the commission, obviously, but our hope would be that they'd adopt it, but they will take some action. It may not be to adopt it. I had planned on talking about the Fall Creek Hatchery Research Center that we're pretty excited about getting some discussion on. Chair, I know that we're behind schedule, so I will...
We're all right.
We're all right.
We are okay?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
I'll just touch briefly on... this gets at a lot of what we've been talking about with respect to the hatchery tool moving in a new direction. And some of the challenges that we have for the future are to develop methods and techniques of producing hatchery fish that contribute to delisting of salmon and steelhead. As we've talked about, this is a new use of the hatchery tool. We also want to contribute toward healthy, sustainable wild populations capable of supporting harvest and improve the management of these by reducing impacts to wild. Now, the Fall Creek Hatchery Research Center is not an end-all or a panacea to these issues, but it is certainly an area that Oregon can take leadership in and contribute towards helping blur the lines between these hatchery and wild fish. This site is located at, I guess I could say, infamous Fall Creek facility in the Alsea drainage.
That's appropriate.
Enough said. It's actually an excellent place for this. What realtors say, location, location, location. It's close to our department research center in Corvallis, close to Oregon State University and the Hatfield Marine Science Center. So logistically, it's very appropriate. As a gravity flow station, good water quality and good water rights. And there's fish habitat upstream, and we have life cycle monitoring already in place in the drainage that gives us a database to build on. It has Chinook, Coho, steelhead, and cutthroat present in the drainage. This is a picture of the current site. And this is the way we typically raise fish, a series of raceways. Doesn't exactly look like a natural stream environment. So this would be a somewhat major undertaking. This shows some of what, I don't know if it's come into clarity for you, but this is a picture of what certain areas of this may look like, where you actually have a race water intake and basically a more natural stream environment that you can do replicates and do actual tests on these fish, see what provides best for their needs.
Ed, Mr. Chairman, if I may, who else is doing this in the nation or even in North America? a very naturally, mimicking nature in terms of your hatchery.
Chair Jensen and Representative Krupp, there are a lot of recent efforts underway, particularly in the Northwest. I think Northwest is kind of at the lead on some of these approaches. I would mention that probably areas furthest along with some of these are in the Snake River Basin, associated with the initial listings and the need for conservation hatchery tool to be developed.
Okay.
Northeast Oregon within our state is very aggressive, but the some of the tribal hatcheries, I mean, it takes new money to construct these new sort of facilities. And the new money has gone primarily to some of the tribal initiatives, and so we're pretty excited with some of the things they've been able to put together that kind of get a glimpse at some of this. But I'm not, there's only a few areas. One of them is at Clay Ellum in Washington, where the Acoma tribes are doing a more aggressive look at this. Another one's Abernathy, which the Fish and Wildlife Service has over in Washington. And it'd be great if the committee was interested in perhaps taking a tour or something of a site like this. That's not too far away. And then you also have some little areas where we're dabbling in this and other areas looking at this. Most of them very research-oriented and able to have some replication in this. Our piece would just be what it is, a piece of the puzzle. We would focus on things that are mainly relevant to Oregon, but it would feed into the whole region. to help address this. Now, I should mention the support for this concept has been pretty much unanimous across constituent group lines as well as management partner lines. We have strong support from the university systems, particularly Oregon State University, our federal and state management partners, and tribal interests in us helping be leaders in moving this forward.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's all, Chair.
Okay. We're on to directors.
Yes, I'll have Robin Brown come up now.
By the way, Mr. Chair, just before Ed leaves, one last question regarding the hatchery research project. When do you envision that reconstruction of Fall Creek beginning?
Chair Jansen and Representative Krupp, the issue is money, as you're probably all well aware. And I'm not prepared right now to talk to you about how we may best go about doing that and whether or not it's appropriate within this session to how far we'd want to go with that. But we are anxious to perhaps provide some seed money from our agency with some dollars that we received for some settlement in the Willamette, and then use that seed money to leverage other partner involvement, both federal, private, and state, in order to cobble together enough to move forward on this. The full project is probably going to require $5 to $7 million, but we would like to get an initial start on this. We feel it is very important and a key element of our hatchery management policy and native fish policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was an excellent point, Representative. I think obviously one that those of us who have been working on these issues would encourage the department to pursue actively while still recognizing that this is not the easiest time in the history of the state to find new monies for something. But certainly if they have a little bit, they may very well be able to leverage some money from some other places, and we would encourage you to pursue that with all the vigor that you have.
Thank you, Chair Jetson. I'm sure the partnerships will be myriad.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and committee members. My name is Robin Brown. I'm employed by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I lead our agency's work on research and monitoring of marine mammal populations in Oregon, specifically seals and sea lions. And I'm happy to be here with you today and provide you an update on what we know about seal and sea lion populations in the state and the current kind of an overview of the current research and monitoring efforts that we are taking on or continuing, and a brief review of what we know currently of the status of the federal law that covers the management and protection of these animals, and what we know of possible actions by National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Congress with respect to hearings and reauthorization of that federal law.
Robin, is it safe to say that we're feeding these predators reasonably well?
Yes, it is, Chair Jensen. They're doing quite well in this part of the world. As you'll see by the brief comments here on the page two I presented to you on the status of the species, primarily there's three seal and sea lion species in Oregon. A few others occur occasionally, but the first listed here, the stellar sea lion Oregon resident breeding population, is currently at about 4,500 animals and has been growing at about 3.5% per year over the past 25 years. This species is listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act, due primarily to major declines in the central portions of its range in Alaska, but from Oregon up through southeast Alaska, it's doing fairly well. For our purposes, stellar sea lions tend to be a little bit more of an offshore species, with the exception of the lower Rogue River, we really don't have too much in the way of negative interactions between fisheries and fish resources. And these animals, with the exception of, again, of the lower Rogue River, where these animals are fairly common. California sea lion population, and this summary comes from National Marine Fisheries Service data, that population has been growing at about 5% at an average annual rate for the past 25 years and may be approaching a total U.S. population of around 300,000 animals. It's kind of hard to say how many of these animals show up in Oregon. They're here seasonally from fall through spring following the summer breeding period. And we estimate that at least somewhere between 5 and 10,000 of these animals move north into Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia during that period of year. So they're all flooding north through Oregon waters and then south again in the summertime to return to the breeding areas in Southern California. And then Pacific harbor seals are, of course, a resident. They're the most common and abundant animal, a pinniped on the coast of Oregon. We do have a resident and year-round population estimated at about 7,500 at this point. And this population, in contrast to the other two, has been stable for about the past 10 years. And we feel that it has probably reached what the federal law refers to as an optimum sustainable population level, which essentially is in some stability with its current carrying capacity. The last two species there, the California sea lion and the harbor seal, are the ones we're most common with, and they're the ones that are most typical in the nearshore and inland coastal waters that the public interacts with in a lot of ways, private property owners, sport and commercial fishing operations, and of course, where the typical interactions with some of the fishery resources we're most concerned about take place. In general, the kind of research that we've been conducting for years and are trying to continue working on includes our annual assessments of the populations by way of aerial photo surveys. We conduct these at various times of the year for the different species. We are also conducting ongoing food habit studies where we collect scatter fecal samples from these animals at a variety of locations statewide on somewhat on an opportunistic basis, but as we can, to put together a picture of seal and sea lion food habits in Oregon. And then more recently, in the past 3 or 4 years, we've been participating in a West Coast working group that is coordinated and funded primarily by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And this group is looking at pinniped or seal and sea lion predation on salmonids primarily, with a focus on threatened and endangered stocks. Now, I've talked to some of you, Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, about this effort in the past. It consists of the three lower West Coast state fish and wildlife agencies, a number of folks from academic institutions from California to Washington, and at least one tribe, the Yurok tribe on the Klamath, has been looking at sea lion predation on Chinook there. We've to date have a variety of information that's come in from this work, and don't really have time to go into it in detail with you at this point, but I'd be glad to provide additional information at a later time. But as you would expect, we've uncovered have experienced a variety of interactions and levels of possible impact on salmon and steelhead, depending on the study areas. And again, they range from harbor seals and steelhead in central California streams through Oregon up into Hood Canal, where the Department of Fish and Wildlife has been looking at seal predation on chum salmon that have been identified for possible listings. So a lot of work is going on there. The National Marine Fisheries Service is continuing to support that work, and we actually have a meeting later this month to talk about research that will take place in the following year. And, of course, we've received support and direction from previous legislative assemblies to continue and carry on with that work. In the management or administration area, The Marine Mammal Protection Act, of course, is the federal law that covers these species. The state does not have management authority for them. The law was first enacted in 1972. It was most recently amended in 1994. And in 1994, Congress directed the National Marine Fisheries Service to look at the questions of seal and sea lion predation on threatened and endangered salmonids. And that is the action or the direction that led to the development of the West Coast Working Group. NIMS has continued to provide funding to those efforts for the states through the Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission, which has been a great ally and resource for our agency in obtaining those funds from the overall NOAA budget. Out of some of that early effort, National Marine Fisheries Service submitted a report to Congress in 1999, which focused on the issues of seals and sea lions and salmonids, and it recommended essentially a new framework that would provide for some management options for dealing with seal and sea lion interactions with threatened and endangered salmonids and our efforts to recover those populations. To date, there's been no congressional action on that recommendations report from NIMS. The most recent action by Congress on the MMPA was a bill, H.R. 4781, which was introduced last May in the House Resource Committee, and it would have reauthorized the law, but the only area in which it dealt specifically with seals and sea lions was to recommend further work on development of non-lethal control measures for what they termed nuisance pinnipeds. In other words, these situations where we have known individual animals in certain areas that appear to be repeatedly foraging on threatened and endangered salmonids up and down the coast. As far as we know to date, from contacts I've had with the Northwest Region National Marine Fisheries Service folks in Seattle, NOAA Fisheries does not propose any action in the 108th Congress unless specifically asked to comment or provide information by Congress. And what Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife intends to do is serve on a Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission committee for reauthorization of the law if the opportunity should arise for states to provide comment or fishing industry representatives to provide comment based on any congressional action that might take place on the law. So very briefly, that's kind of a summary of where we are and what we've been doing, and I'd be glad to try to entertain questions if there are any.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, I've reintroduced the bill I did last time, and the genesis of that legislation was a conversation with Congressman DeFazio, who said that states, under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, states have the ability to petition the federal government for exemption or exceptions under that act. And my whole purpose of my legislation was to try to aggressively seek those exemptions where we have known problems. And you know, this whole thing of non-lethal control, these critters are smart. You can move them anywhere, they're going to come back. So any comment on I mean, I think this is the direction we should be going, and the amazing part was, up until 2 years ago, when I had this conversation with the congressman, I didn't know we had the ability to do that. So is that something that is reasonable, to try to petition Congress for the ability to deal with point-specific things, or is that process so cumbersome and onerous that it makes it impractical?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, the short answer to all of those points, I suppose, is yes. We will be providing, of course, comments on your introduced bill. The federal law does provide under Section 109 for transfer of management of species back to the state. One of the previously impassable hurdles has been the requirement to determine that a population of marine mammals for which you're requesting management authority is at its optimum sustainable population level. And I think when we talked 2 years ago, we were a little reluctant. We were suggesting that harbor seals in the Pacific Northwest may be at that state. We were a little reluctant to commit to it, and we looked at a few more years of data. But now our trend surveys and those in Oregon, Washington, and apparently California as well, show that harbor seal populations have flattened out over the past 8 to 10 years and probably are defensively within their optimum sustainable population level. That was a key trigger under Section 109 of the MMPA for states to request transfer of management authority. Getting to your other comment about, I'm not sure what term you used, I think of quagmire comes to mind, but the OSP requirement was only one of many issues and requirements of the state to request transfer of management and receive transfer of management. It is something that is provided for in the law. One of the major hurdles, at least at this point, appears to have been met, although I would add that we could expect to receive significant legal and scientific challenge to those data and our interpretation of them from those who would rather not see management authority transferred to the state, so that's to be expected. Beyond that, the development of a management program for these species would be very similar to that for any other wildlife management program that the state would undertake. It would include require a lot of input from various constituencies in the public and meetings and developments of plans and options. And as you are well aware, there could be quite a bit of social controversy involved in some of those decisions and proposed actions. And then ultimately, in the state management plan would still be overseen or under the umbrella of the Federal Protection Act. So it isn't what I would think of as a panacea for solving a lot of these problems that we're looking at, but as Representative DeFazio indicated to you, it is provided for under the federal law.
I guess, Mr. Chair, just the whole point, I if we're expecting some modification at the federal level, I think for us to, under their provisions, to actually do take of pinnipeds, we're probably decades away from that, potentially. And clearly, I think there are cases, point specific in Oregon, where take is the only way we mitigate the impact.
Chair Jensen, please. I've lost my share of fish to these guys on the boat. Not very civil language when that happens, but if we're at the optimal population, I would assume the federal government would want them to remain at the optimal population. So if they're a problem at this population, there's probably not a whole lot we can do as far as the population goes. But Chair Jensen said we are feeding them. They're quite well fed. As I asked Mr. Bowles, are we doing, I assume they're rather conditioned, and are they just conditioned on the fish we release, or are they conditioned because of the returns, or both? And is there anything we can do to decondition them if that's the case, or do we even know any of that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, help me out again if I miss a couple of those points. As far as conditioning, I mean, I think these animals, from the thousands of hours of observations that we've done now, looking at seals and sea lions preying on salmon and steelhead in coastal inland waters, the Alsea system is one of our primary study areas. I suspect that these animals don't focus from a hatchery fish to a wild fish or anything like that. They utilize these inland waters primarily and probably because of the ability to drive fish into areas where they can catch them. Some of these adult Chinook in the fall in the Alsea, for example, are half to three-quarters the length of a typical harbor seal. So these are big prey items that is not typically their prey that they consume throughout the year. They much more commonly eat small prey species throughout the year and a variety of species at that. But they take advantage of shallows and restrictions in fish passage areas, low water flows early in the fall where fish come into the lower estuary and back up, and then the seals have an advantage at that point in getting them. I don't think they probably select too much between, you know, what stock or where this particular group of fish came from. Anywhere that there are salmonids in the coastal systems and seals nearby, you know, this type of predatory behavior has been observed. And I apologize, I think I probably missed at least one other point of your question.
But, I mean, there's nothing we can do about that, is there? I mean, they've been doing it forever, I would assume.
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, yes, I mean, that's one of the points that is often made, is that these animals have coexisted successfully for millions of years, and there are, due to a variety of factors that may have reduced fish abundance or health of fish stocks and increased health of an abundance of predator stocks, you know, which we have manipulated in a variety of fashions, some of these predation events have become more significant. And as we're trying to recover depressed or low abundance level fish stocks, some of these predation effects could very well have negative effects that we'd like to avoid. As far as what to do about it, the law, until someone put in effect a management plan with a variety of options, there is no management provided for under the current law. National Marine Fisheries Service really doesn't even have the authority to manage these types of problems at this point in time. A lot of focus has gone to non-lethal development of non-lethal means. Obviously, that's attractive to a lot of folks. As Representative Cruz pointed out, they tend not to be very effective over the long run, and the animals are very sharp, so they learn how to avoid these sorts of things. When you get right down to it, and we know that these animals develop, individual animals develop learned behavior and demonstrate these behaviors year after year. When you get right down to it, as was experienced in Washington State with the California sea lions and the steelhead at Ballard Locks, removal of those individual animals is the ultimate key for reducing your interaction, negative interaction at that particular site.
Thank you. Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Robin, I have a series of questions. The first one is, on Stellar Sea Lions, you list the Oregon resident breeding population. Do you have a figure in mind as to what the overall Stellar population is?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, I should have. I'll struggle to do so. The worldwide population back in the mid-30s, 40s, 50s used to be close to about 300,000 animals. It's declined, I believe, to a total worldwide population now of somewhere around 40, 50, or 60,000 animals. It's a very, very significant decline in the center portion of its range, which is from about the center of the Gulf of Alaska out to the end of the Aleutian chain.
So Stellars are really just found in the North American coast.
That's correct, Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp. We're primarily at the southeastern end of their normal distribution.
And have the California sea lion population of about 300,000 estimated, is that considered an optimal sustainable population for California?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, if I might take just a minute, the federal law defines optimum sustainable population as that range of abundance levels for any species that's bounded on the lower end by its maximum annual rate of increase. So when the population is most productive and adding the largest number of new to its population every year, that's the maximum level of production. Theoretically, that's something below the highest level that the environment can carry, and that's the upper end of the range is bounded by the environmental capacity to house those animals in that species. It's thought that depending on the species, that range may not be very large, as I believe Representative Cruz mentioned, maybe it was Representative Schaffler, that there may not be much management ability within that range for any particular species. So what's happened is we don't know, and this was the case with harbor seals, we really don't know when one of these species has passed that maximum annual rate of increase until the population stops growing. We really don't know where the maximum net productivity level is for these species, but we can infer they've reached the carrying capacity when their population stops growing over a period of time. Right now, the population of California sea lions has not shown that decline in growth, there are those that feel that, that it's probably getting close to that level.
Okay. And then in regards to dams and when we hear salmon returns that sort of get they're trying to go up the ladders and seals or sea lions come up and feast on them. Has that been a problem that ODF&W or even for that matter the 1999 NIMS report to Congress established as real?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, yes, it is a real problem, and it's occurred at a number of sites. Again, one of the most famous ones is probably the Ballard Locks area in Seattle from the mid-80s through the mid-90s, where the California sea lions were taking fish as they entered a fish ladder there. We've conducted observations over the past 5 or 6 years at Willamette Falls, where we have anywhere from a half a dozen to a dozen California sea lions that come all the way up to Columbia and turn right at Portland and come up to the falls and stay from March through May and forage on both Spring Chinook and Willamette Basin steelhead there. And more recently, the Army Corps of Engineers biologists at Bonneville have been looking at sea lion predation on salmonids passing through those facilities. They just started this last spring. So there are a number of examples of where this occurs, and it's a matter of conducting enough observations. These animals have to bring these large fish to the surface to kill them. So if you've got a concentrated feeding area, you can observe it quite effectively and enumerate how many fish are being lost. And this is what was done at Ballard Locks and what we've done at Willamette Falls and what they're attempting to do at Bonneville. So these areas can be important. What we have found, at least at Willamette Falls to date, is that we estimate that there are somewhere between 200 and 400 salmonids, both Chinook and steelhead, that are probably taken by these half a dozen sea lions for over a two-month period right in the immediate vicinity of the falls. Now, there's other predation that occurs down the stream that we're not able to measure from there. So our best interpretation at this point is that overall, unless we're dealing with really low abundances of the wild winter steelhead stock, we are not overly concerned with the level of loss that seems to be taking place there right now. That level of information has not been obtained at Bonneville to date. The information from Ballard Locks, of course, was that it was a very, very serious loss of steelhead at that system at the time the sea lions were most effective.
And has anyone engaged in using some kind of protection measures at the dams? So in other words, when you have something along the lines of nets where the openings of the net are large enough for the fish to swim through, but the seals or sea lions could not follow. Has that been employed, to your knowledge?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, it has. A net system was deployed at Ballard Locks as one of the many tools that they tried over a 6 or 8 year period before they captured and removed a few sea lions. The net system entangled and drowned a couple of sea lions, and they pulled it after that because of negative comments from folks that didn't like that as an outcome.
Was it effective?
Of the tool. It was effective at keeping animals away from the immediate entrance to the fish ladder. There was at least one animal, if I recall, that somehow got above the net, though, and so was feeding within the closed area. A number of other tools have been tried, from noisemakers to harassment devices projectiles fired from rubber-fired bullets and that sort of thing have been tried. What they found at Ballard Locks was once they were able to remove these three or four animals that were really the repeat offenders, the ones that had learned this is where they wanted to feed for that period of time, Then they use an acoustic system that plays noise that's not within the frequency range that can be detected by the fish, but is somewhat annoying to the sea lions, and so it at least has deterred the new animals from moving into that area to set up these feeding territories. It probably will happen eventually, however, that there will be animals that move back in there.
Mr. Chair, may I ask
and one last question here. In the report, well, it's a two-part question. The H.R. 4781 that was introduced in Congress that no action was taken on, was that a recommendation from the 99 report to the National Marine Fisheries Service?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, yes, it was. The development of effective non-lethal deterrence was one of the recommendations that was made in the 99 NIMS report. And that report, by the way, was developed with direct input from the three West Coast states by way of Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission. So we did have input into those recommendations.
And Mr. Chair, last question. Did that 1999 report reach conclusions that stated very clearly that there needed to be or that pinnipeds were having a negative effect on salmonid populations?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, you bring up a good point. And at the time that report was developed, the Ballard Locks situation was really the only well-documented and high-visibility situation that could be used as an example for why NIMS was requesting increased management authority for seals and sea lions on behalf of the states and the federal agency. That was a major critique at the time that the report was prepared and submitted. I think since some of the results of the work that's been done since then, when that work is brought together and is put out in a report form, which National Marine Fisheries Service intends to do, there will be examples in there that add to argument to a need for increased management authority in certain situations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And it's just to that. I mean, sea lions, they die every day. A polar bear would love to eat one. They're prey as well as predators. If these nets work, surely we should be. There must be some discussion going on where there is an acceptable level of sacrificing a seal or two in order to maintain a sustainable population of salmon or steelhead. I mean, that seems to be a fairly decent balance there. If there's just a couple, I mean, I wouldn't want to be one of them, but let's face it, they die all the time in natural settings. I would see them. Is there some kind of discussion going on to try and find what an acceptable amount in a loss due to these nets would be?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, That discussion in general is and has been going on for some time, and the bigger picture of it is, you know, why do we provide nearly complete protection for these animals that are very part of very healthy and abundant populations in this part of the world under this one federal law, yet we try to recover threatened and endangered and depleted salmonid stocks under another federal law, the Endangered Species Act, and other state actions. That question has been debated a lot. With respect to your specific question of the example of nets as barriers to keep animals away from certain fish passage facilities, under the law, there's only a couple of options to do that sort of thing. One is by way of obtaining a marine mammal research permit, where you go out and define you're going to test a particular mitigation measure to reduce these negative effects, and then you can conduct that work and measure your results, both positive and negative. Those are generally short-term, relatively short-term, and not viewed as management. As soon as you kind of turn that corner and it becomes clear that what you're proposing to do is a management action, granted a valid one to try to preserve fish, then the law no longer covers those. There's a little section in section 109 of the law that says the state can do the things it needs to do to deal with nuisance animals to protect public safety, the welfare of the animal, and there's one other category, I apologize, I can't recall. But it's not really broad enough to use that section of the law to implement a management program that would entail deploying barriers at a variety of different sites just to keep seals and sea lions away. That borders on a direct management action for which the state does not have authority.
Mr. Just one more comment, and then I'll shut up. But it just seems to me that if we were going to go out and kill 5,000 or 6,000 seals, I could see the uproar. But if we're talking about 5 or 6 out of 300,000, I just can't see the sense in it.
Yeah. Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, I my personal opinion is that I agree with you. I think there's an imbalance there that's very clear and very, very obvious. One of the comments that the state has made through these recommendations to Congress is that there is a current system that allows commercial fishing operations to, incidental to their operations, cause the injury and mortality of seals and sea lions. Mm-hmm. And the federal government, through NOAA Fisheries, provides a way to determine, based on the population's status and size and growth, so taking California sea lions, for example, there is what's called a potential biological removal number for California sea lions that's 3,000 or 4,000 animals that can legally be taken incidental, taken meaning seriously injured or killed, incidental to commercial fishing operations on the west coast of the United States. But there is no similar provision in the law that would allow a state or federal management agency to utilize some of those takes under the PBR level. And we made that comment pretty clear that we thought that approach to allow commercial fisheries to operate and protect their gear and catch could easily be applied to a state or federal management agency that's trying to protect and recover a particular fish stock in a coastal stream.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler, welcome to the wonderful world of the federal government.
With seeing no further questions, with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.